Well, I'm going to invite you to turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 10. If you would, there's an outline that you may have received as you came in. If you're interested in that, that will help you track along with what we're going to be talking about this morning out of the book of Acts. Before we dive into that, let me tell you a couple of things, just sort of announcement-wise. One, if I can do anything possible to encourage those of you that are couples to be part of our couples conference this weekend, I want to do that. There is not, for those of you that are married, there's not a lot more important things for you to invest in than the investment that you can make of a time like this in the life of your marriage. There's not a lot of other options like this on island. And we do this couples conference at Harvest only every other year. And so no matter where your marriage is at, if you guys are really thriving right now, it'd be good for you. If this is a period of time where you're going through some rocky times, no matter where you're at, let me encourage you to be a part of that. And you can sign up both online and out at the Welcome Center after the service, but we'd love to have you there. Invite somebody to come along with you, another couple. It'd be a great way to connect them and allow them to meet some of the other people at church. So that's the first thing. Second, I want you to know that beginning February 3rd, we're going to begin a new series that's going to go maybe 9 or 10 sessions, February 3rd, on growing in grace. And so this has been our theme for the year, growing in grace and truth. And we're going to take some weeks and just talk about this whole topic of grace. And what does God's word have to say about grace? How does that impact you and your relationship to God? And then how does that flow out into your horizontal relationships with the people around you? I think that the idea of grace is one of the most fundamental foundational ideas for you as a believer and how you interact with other people and how you view your relationship to God. And so I'm looking forward to that. It begins, we'll start that up February 3rd. I'd love you to be a part of, you know, each of those sessions as we spend time there. And then one last thing. Yesterday over in our Family Life Center, we had a great time together in something we called the Discipleship Seminar. We've got a couple of pictures here. I think nearly just under 60 people that were part of this Discipleship Seminar, where we just talked about the responsibility that we shared together in a couple of Sundays in the month of December about God's call to us, primarily as a church, to be a disciple-making church. And then your responsibility or our responsibility individually to be disciple makers. I think that's what Matthew 28 and the Great Commission calls us to do. And so we had such an awesome turnout. It was just a great time yesterday for a couple of hours talking about discipleship and our desire as a church family to be actively, purposefully, intentionally involved in what God's called us to do there. And I guess I wanted to make just one note. If you are here this morning and you'd say, you know, I'm looking for a spiritual mentor, a spiritual coach, someone to walk along beside me as I'm figuring out my spiritual life and working through things. I got questions. I really feel like that would be helpful for me. We have opportunities for you, and so you can tell me about that. Pastor Brian is sort of heading this up. He's sort of the key guy. You can tell him. You can stop at the Welcome Center and just leave a note for somebody. You can call up to the office, but if you're one to say, I'm really at that place, I'd love somebody to come along and help me in some of my spiritual questions. We want to help you in that way, and so those opportunities are available. Well, I had you turn to Acts chapter 10. And this morning, we're going to look at a very contemporary question. Probably a question that has come across your mind at some time or another, maybe even a question that's bothered you as you've thought about it. And here's the question. As long as a person is genuinely sincere, what difference does it make what they believe? You may have heard somebody ask a question like that before. I mean, You believe what you believe, and I'm going to believe what I believe. And as long as we're all sincere about that, we're both going to be okay. I mean, it's the sincerity that is the key part in this. God doesn't have more than that. Let's just believe what you believe, and everybody's okay in that. What I'd like to do this morning is, first of all, tell you that it makes a huge difference what you believe. All right, I want to tell you that first. And I hope to prove it to you, convince you, by a very interesting testimony in the Bible that comes up in Acts 10 and chapter 11. And I'm going to take a few minutes this morning to introduce this before we actually get into the text, maybe a little bit longer time introducing it. But we're going to find an interesting guy by the name of Cornelius that shows up in this text that we're going to overview, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. So let me tell you a couple things as introduction. Number one, the issue is not sincerity, but reality. All right, and we're going to try to prove that to you. The issue is not sincerity, but reality. It's not how much you believe something, or how diligently, or how passionately you believe something. But the issue is whether what you believe is true. All right? So that's foundational for us. A person can be very sincere and still be sincerely wrong. For example, I could believe this morning with all my heart that my wife has baked for me and our family a big, beautiful apple pie for us to eat later this afternoon. My wife doesn't bake a lot of, she's a very good pie maker, but I could believe that with all of my heart. I could believe that. And in fact, I could even act on this in some ways. We're having watch care groups after our service this morning through the afternoon, and I could say, you know what? I might come to your house. Faith and I will go to several different watch care groups, but I'm going to eat very light because we got apple pie when I get back home. So I'm going to be very careful because I know everything in me. I know that there's an apple pie that's waiting for us later this afternoon. So I'm going to be very careful. I could act on it. I could believe it with all of my heart. I say apple pie because apple pie is sort of special to me. I want to let you know that. along with banana pie, with what's that? Oh, graham cracker crust, just if you wanted to know. Blueberry pie, cherry pie. All right. My dad, who's here, my dad is staying with us for a few months teaching at HBBC in some classes. We're so glad that he's here with us. I'll tell you a little story about my dad. All the time that I was growing up, my dad loves apple pie too, if you wanted to know about that. And all the time that I was growing up, very regularly after we ate our family dinner, my dad would lean back in his chair and he'd sort of fold his hands and he'd say, "I can't decide if I want apple pie or cheese with my, if I want ice cream or cheese with my apple pie today." He'd say that many, many dinners. Now you have to know, my mom probably baked about a handful of pies her entire life, all right? So we all knew there was no apple pie for us after dinner, except Dad would say it. And by the way, some of you are like, how many of you eat cheese with your apple pie? Anybody here? All right, Dad, you got some friends here. Here's the saying from my dad as I was growing up about this. He said, "Apple pie without the cheese is like a kiss without the squeeze." So he would say after dinner, "I'm not sure if I want apple, if I want ice cream or cheese with my apple pie," but he knew there wasn't any apple pie coming. All right, back to my story. That was kind of separate. It doesn't matter how much I firmly believe today that we're going to have apple pie later in this afternoon. It doesn't matter how much I act upon it, all the decisions that I make about it. The reality is that today, I don't think, unless it happened sometime I wasn't watching, I don't think we're having apple pie at the Walton House this afternoon. So it's not about the sincerity or how much we believe something. It is about the object in which with which we believe. Our beliefs, no matter how deeply held, are always subject to reality. That's true in all areas of life, isn't it? I mean, sincerely believing that it's safe to cross the road doesn't help if there's a big old Mack truck, you know, barreling down the road towards you. You can believe all you want that it's safe to cross if that's not the reality. Thinking the speed limit is 65 when it's 35 will not prevent you from getting a ticket. I don't care how long and how much you try to convince the officer that I really believed. I thought it was 65. Right? Our beliefs, no matter how deeply held, are always subject to reality. And strongly holding to your beliefs about God doesn't make them true. You see, the thing that really matters, here's the second little point on that introduction, is not the sincerity of our faith, but the object of our faith. We have to make sure that the object and the facts in which we're putting our faith into is trustworthy. That's the point. Trustworthiness of the object of our faith, not so much the sincerity or the passion with which we believe something. There are two different ways that we use the words believe and faith in the scriptures. I'm going to just mention them for you and then illustrate this. One is a mental belief, and one is a practical faith. So when the Bible talks about belief, it's talking about more than just the mental assent, the intellectual belief in something. When the Bible talks about belief, when the Bible talks about faith, it's talking about a practical, foundational belief. I'll try to illustrate that here in a minute. Even in the Bible, it says that there are many people that believed in Jesus Christ. In fact, one of the interesting texts said that the devils even believed. All right? So they accepted intellectually the reality of Jesus Christ, but that's a different word and a different definition than the belief and faith that produces some step of action or response to it, all right? So two different things. I'm going to try to illustrate that for you this morning in this way. I asked Sebastian if he would come up here and help me for a minute. Sebastian, Basil Jua, come right on up here, Sebastian. I'm going to put these chairs here. So this is a very simple exercise right there. You're good. Sebastian, everybody, welcome. So we're going to do this little experiment this morning, and we're going to, I needed somebody that would sit up on platform with us during this service. We're not really going to make him do this eventually, but let's say we needed some more space, so I asked Sebastian if he'd just sit up on the platform during our service, and so I'm going to ask Sebastian if he would choose the chair that he wants to sit in of these three, but I want to tell you that two of these chairs, before we got in here this morning, we have removed strategically some of the bolts, all right? Two of these chairs have the bolts strategically removed. One of them is good, all right? So, Sebastian, you have to choose right now. Which one of these chairs are you going to choose? So, Sebastian says, this is the chair that you're going to choose. All right, you really convinced this is the one?
Yes.
Are you sure? You want to choose one of these, Sebastian? So, what if I told you that this is the chair that's the good one? Do you want to change your mind now? Sebastian said I'd have to prove it to him. That's a good thought. What if, Sebastian, what if we polled the audience here and we asked them if they could help us and sort of like phone a friend kind of an idea, if they could, we won't do this, if they could cheer for the chair that they think you should pick, would that change your mind? This is a smart guy right there, I'll tell you. He doesn't trust me and he doesn't trust you. Sebastian, what would be the one thing that would really help you to decide which one of these chairs that you wanted to sit in? He said if he saw somebody sit in it, or if he tried it himself. All right? Actually, that's all I need, Sebastian. Thank you for that. Good choice. You don't even have to sit. Yeah, thank you. All right, there's a couple important things. We're going to get to Acts here in just real quick, but these are foundational for what we're talking about. So it doesn't matter how sincere, if I did, and I didn't, the chairs are still good. That's a point too, but it doesn't matter how sincerely Sebastian believes something to be true, right? What matters is the object of his belief. Doesn't matter if he believed the one on the right is the good one, if it's actually the one on the left. In faith, in belief, it's always about the reality, the object of what we're putting our faith in. And it doesn't matter how many people try to convince you of one thing or the other, right? Our foundation always has to be in what is the truth. In fact, I would tell you this, that the Bible calls us to examine the truth. It doesn't call us to, this is an interesting thing, because faith is always in the unseen, but the Bible doesn't call us to blind faith, unthinking faith. It calls us to think and examine and discover, and it would be right for Sebastian to go and look underneath the chairs, right? Determine the validity of which one would be possible before he puts his faith in the chair. And the last thing that I would say, well, two last things I would say on this. One is that that his belief is different standing up here looking at the chairs and pointing than it is if I were to ask him to go over and sit on it. That's the two different kinds of faith. When he sits down, this is the exercise of his faith. This is what the Bible calls us to. And the last thing I'd say about this is that it's possible that all three chairs will hold him up. And I say that because of this reason. So some would say there are multiple ways to get to heaven. All right, that's what we started off. You go your way, I'll go my way. But we'll all eventually get there as long as we're sincere. It is logically, potentially possible that that's true. But here's the thing. You're going to have to know for sure if that's true. It is possible that all three chairs will hold him up. But he's going to have to know for sure. He's going to have to discover it. So those that would think that, my comment would be, is it possible that there could be multiple ways to get to heaven? For sure, there could be. But you better know. And you better discover it. Because that's not good enough to say, that's how I'd like it to be. And it's not good enough just to say, that's how I, maybe even in your mind, that's how you hope it would be. You better know. And the foundation for the answer to those questions are found in the scriptures. And that's where we're going to go here in Acts chapter 10. So there's this interesting testimony I told you about a man named Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. Actually, these two chapters are packed full of all kinds of interesting things. I mean, we've got visions. Both Cornelius and Peter experience a vision from God, two different locations. We have a very big discussion of the gospel. We could go to some verses and just talk about the clarity of the gospel that Peter preaches. There's some verses in here that talk about the breaking down of the walls of racial and ethnic prejudices, and we'll hint at those verses. There's a lot that's packed into this story. All we're doing in the time that we have here is we're taking a little slice out of this story in order to answer one question, all right? So I'm going to try to put the context together for you, but don't misunderstand this. We're not going to understand everything about these two chapters in the time that we have here. But let's begin reading in verse 1. Let me talk you through this. There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the band called the Italian Band. All right, we find out some interesting things about this guy Cornelius in this one verse. Most interesting, at least to me, is that we have this sense that Cornelius was a real man's man, kind of a a manly soldier that we find described for us. Centurion, if you track the word, obviously means that he commanded a century of men or 100 men. But more than that, his military leadership of leading 100 men is that the centurions were considered the backbone of the Roman army. In fact, as they put their armies together, the centurion was a leader over, or the centuries were groups of 100 men. They had cohorts, which were six centuries or 600 men. And then they had legions, which were 10 cohorts or 6,000 men, all right? Three different categories of military leaders in the Roman army. So Cornelius, in his role, was a centurion, all right? The leader of 100 men. He would have been roughly equivalent to a sergeant major or a captain over a company. But here's the interesting thing about that. The commanders of the cohorts and the legions were generally appointed positions. They tended to be sort of people that had connections. They were aristocrats in the Roman society who served for, you know, a short period of time, maybe a year or two, on their way to civilian office. It was an entry level for them to get into the Roman government. They were appointed positions. But the centurions were career military men. These guys earned their rank. It wasn't appointed to them by who they knew. They earned their rank because of their strength and their responsibility and their leadership skills. That's why they were called the backbone of the Roman army. Roman historian Polybius describes centurions as not so much venturesome daredevils as natural leaders of a steady and sedate spirit. Not so much men who will initiate attacks and open battle as men who will hold their ground when worsted and hard-pressed and be ready to die at their posts. These were the real leaders. These were the enlisted leaders of the Roman army. And Cornelius was the kind of man that you would have been proud to stand with in battle. You could trust him. He'd been through the wars. Now look at verse 2. It says, Cornelius is a devout man and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. All right, so more than just a good soldier, this is a great guy. I want you to notice three things that help us answer this question. We're getting to, is religious sincerity enough? That's the question. Here's three things that will help us. Number one, he was a model of religious respectability. Verse 2 tells us he was a devout and moral man. In fact, it tells us that in three ways. It says three things about him. I'm going to give these to you real briefly, but if you're interested in writing them down. Number one, he was sincere. Says he was a devout man who feared God. We're not talking about someone here who is just going through the religious motions. He just wasn't just showing up in church kind of to be part of the process. This was a devout man who feared God. He was sincere. Number two, he was sacrificial. He gave much alms to the people. So not only was Cornelius sincere, but he acted out his beliefs. He gave to local charities. He was trying to do what was right. He was doing a lot of good works. In fact, if you go down in the passage a little bit in verse 22, it says, I won't read it, but it says that Cornelius was of good report among all the nation. All right, he was a man, as a Roman authority among the Jewish people, he was a man who held their respect. He had a good reputation. If you ask the people who knew Cornelius if he was a man of faith, all of them would say, you bet, of course, we know he is. He's a man of faith. Number three, he was searching. All right, this is going to start turn our picture to where we're trying to go with this. Again, it's interesting. It says he prayed to God always. Look down again later in the passage, verse 30. It talks about him fasting and praying. He's asking God for answers. In fact, I think that verse in particular tells us that he was asking God to help him so that he would know the truth. I think that's what he's looking for. His religion was not some formality. It was not a charade that he was putting on to try to impress people. He wasn't becoming religious so that people would think more of him. Cornelius was trying to find God. You may know some people to whom religion is just external to them, and that might be your view of what religion is, but that's not what it was to Cornelius. He was as sincere as he could be, and he was searching. You can just read this, and again, we're not reading all the way through the text, but you can just read it in every part. He was searching, and he wanted to know the truth. So, as sincere as he could be, and as much as he was trying to do what was right, in every way a model of morality and religious respectability, but the rest of the passage tells us that he was not a Christian. You say, well, what makes you think that he's not a Christian? I mean, you need to find all the things that you would think would be descriptions of a Christian. He's sincere. He's sacrificial. He's searching. He's given his alms to the poor. I mean, all the things that would sort of tell us this guy's a Christian, but this passage tells us he was not. First, he had no assurance of his eternal destiny. He was still searching. You see that through the whole chapter, but I want you to see it particularly as we keep reading in verse 3, all right? Here's Cornelius. He saw a vision, evidently about the ninth hour of the day, an angel of God coming into him and saying unto him, Cornelius. And when he looked on him, he was afraid, and he said, what is it, Lord? And he said unto him, thy prayers and thine alms are come up for a memorial before God. And now send men to Joppa and call for one Simon, whose surname is Peter. He lodgeth there with one Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the seaside. All right, and then this part of the verse, I've got it underlined. It's important for where we're going here. He says, he shall tell thee what thou oughtst to do. So Cornelius is sincere and he's devout, but he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what the truth is. God comes to him, or a messenger comes to him in a dream. He says, go find Simon, Peter. We're going to find out the same time God's talking to Simon in a dream. That's a whole other piece of this story. Go find Simon, Peter, because he's going to tell you the answers to the questions that you've been asking. He's going to tell you what you should do. In fact, if you look over at chapter 11, verse 14, in chapter 11, Peter, the story has already taken place, and Peter has gone back to Jerusalem, and he's rehearsing the story to the people there in Jerusalem, and so this is sort of a second telling of the same thing, but this is how verse 14, Peter describes what Cornelius and his vision meant. He said, who shall tell thee words, all right, it's talking about, this is the messenger telling him, go find Peter, who shall tell thee words whereby thou and all thy house shall be saved. Right. So Cornelius was not saved. Something was a matter that he needed salvation from. Even though he was sincere and he was searching. And when he was searching, God sent a messenger to him and he said, I'm going to give you the answer. And the answer's going to come through a guy named Peter. And I want you to go find Peter. Here's where you're going to find him, because he's going to tell you how you can be saved. All right, that's the word. So you say, well, what's that mean? What's this saved word about? And I'm going to give you a little definition of it. Saved means this, to deliver or protect. to heal, to preserve, to do well, to be, or to make whole. It's the word that means to rescue. So Cornelius needed rescue, and his house, he needed rescue from something. We don't know yet what he needed rescue from, but he's supposed to go tell Simon, and Simon's going to come and help him to understand the truth that he needs to know in order to find this rescue, in order that he and his house could be saved. I couldn't help but think of many of the stories of people here at Harvest. Many of your testimonies, it's very similar to this. I was religious, maybe at different levels. Some of your stories was, I was a certain religion, but I didn't really go to church. Or I was religious and I went to church regularly, and I tried to do the right things and I was sincere about it. I wasn't fake, and I prayed and I tried to talk to God, but there came a point in my life where I realized that something was missing. Right? That's the story of many, many people that are here at Harvest. I was religious and I was sincere, but there came this point, just like Cornelius, when I knew that something was missing. Number two, he knew that his religious devotion was not enough to merit or earn salvation. Just because he was a dedicated, moral, sincerely religious person who wanted to know God, that was not enough. He had all those things, but he knew it was not enough. So if we can accept the idea that religious sincerity is not enough, it really doesn't matter how much I believe that, that chair will hold me up. If you take the bolts out of it, I'm going to fall. Doesn't matter how much I believe it. Then just exactly what is the key that brings us to genuine salvation and relationship with God? If it's not sincerity, if it's not just believing something, if it's all about the object in which the truthfulness of that which we will believe, then what is it? That's the third thing. All right, he was not left to wonder. God led him to the truth. First, he used a vision, an angel, and then he used Peter. And I guess I would just tell you this morning that if a person is genuinely seeking God and asking questions, you can believe that God will lead them to truth. I've experienced this. I've watched this happen over and over and over again. So those of you that are here that are in that place, you're searching and you're asking questions, I'm so, so thrilled to be part of this process with you. Harvest is part of this process with you because God is going to reveal that truth to you, and he's going to plant it really firmly, deeply in your heart. You're going to know it just as strongly as Cornelius knew what God's going to teach him here. And what was the answer? What was the truth that Cornelius was given? The question I'm going to ask this morning, and I just have a few minutes, but I want to take a few minutes to clarify this. Exactly what is the key that brings us to genuine salvation and relationship with God? What is the key? And it's found in verses 34 through 43. I'm not going to read all of them, but when Simon comes to Cornelius, there's a cool story that's in between there that I skipped over. I know that I did. It'll bring up a lot of questions when you read it. You can ask me about it later. When all that happens and Simon comes to Cornelius, when he comes, he tells Cornelius the gospel. It's a great little section about the truth of the gospel. Who Jesus is, what he did, what the cross is about, and what it accomplished. It's wonderful, this section of the gospel. And it ends in verse 43, and it says this: to him, Jesus, give all the prophets witness that through his name, whosoever believes in him shall receive remission of sins. It's one of the clearest statements of what God asks for every person on the face of this earth and what he's provided for us. Every person who believes in him will receive remission of sins. You see, the problem for Cornelius is the same problem that every man, every woman who has ever lived has the same problem. And that is that we have within us, we were both born with and we live out a sinful nature that causes separation between us and God. The Bible describes God in all of his holiness and all of his perfection, totally apart, set apart from sin. And you and me, as sinners, those who have disobeyed and have fallen short of God's holiness by virtue of our nature and by what we've received from our ancestors and by virtue of our actions, our sin has separated us from God. And this is what Cornelius was searching for. That's why Jesus said, what you need, Cornelius, through his spokesman Peter, is you need remission of sins. You need forgiveness of sins. That's what you've been looking for. Cornelius didn't know it all along. He was trying. He was giving money to the poor. He was trying to do good deeds. He was sincere. He was devout. But he knew something was missing. And what was missing is that all of his good deeds were not enough to forgive the sin barrier that he had in his heart that was separating him from God. And God did not leave him to wonder. He led him to the truth. You say, so how do we receive this forgiveness of sins, that the remission of sins that God is offering to us? And look again at verse 43, because it tells us that whosoever believeth in him shall receive. So the key to forgiveness is belief. And that's the word that we're talking about. That's the faith that Sebastian was sort of demonstrating for us. That's the belief word. It's saying, I understand and know the truth that this chair will hold me up. And if we'd have acted further on this, we would have asked Sebastian to sit down in it. And when he sits down in the chair that has the capacity to hold him up, this is the faith and the belief that the Bible's talking about. It's not a mental assent. It's sitting down in the chair. It's a belief that Jesus died to forgive my sins and that the forgiveness with which God offers to bear this penalty and to relieve the guilt that I've been carrying my entire life, it's in believing Jesus' forgiveness provided for me on the cross. Before I close, I want to challenge you about two things. First of all, Christians, those of you that are here this morning and you know for sure that you're a believer, that your faith has been placed in Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins as the leader of your life, I'm going to tell you something this morning. It is essential that you obey God's word and God's will that you would share your faith. You never know when your witness for Christ is exactly what somebody has been waiting for and praying for. For time's sake, I skipped over the story of Peter. But what if Peter had said, no, I'm not going. I got stuff going on here. And in fact, a lot of this story is about Peter as a Jew wouldn't have had anything to do in that culture with Cornelius, a Roman. I'm not going to tell him. What if Peter had said, I'm sorry, God, I don't want to go talk to that guy. That's not my thing. I got other things to do. Listen, Christian, there is somebody that no one else will reach if you don't. God has put a Cornelius in your life, and he'll keep putting them there, and you are the primary link for him. You got to make sure that you're willing to do what Peter did to share your faith. One of the interesting things about Cornelius' story is how God brought all of these circumstances to the point where he could receive the truth. God had to do a lot of miraculous things as you read down through this chapter. All of these details were not coincidences. God was at work in every part of this, and it's a wonderful weaving of the story as you read through chapter 10 and chapter 11, where God is synergizing all of these events, and the result is that Cornelius would understand for the first time exactly what it was that God wanted for his life. It's wonderful. God brought all of these things together so he'd get it. There are some here that the same thing is happening in your life. Probably not a dream. You probably didn't see an angel. But there's these circumstances in your life that have made you start to think about eternity. That's not a coincidence. Whatever it is that God has brought into your life that's caused you to think about spiritual things and think about eternity, this is not a coincidence. That person in your life or that person at your job or your neighbor or somebody that keeps talking to you about the Bible and you can't seem to get away from it. It's not just fate. Maybe it's a personal interest that you have in the Bible or spiritual things that you didn't have before and you're kind of wondering, why is that happening at this stage of my life? What is going on? I'm telling you, this is God at work in your life in the same way that God worked in Cornelius' life. Whatever the case, these things aren't by accident. They're not coincidences. In fact, the fact that you're here this morning is not by chance. The fact that we're talking about this particular topic is not by chance. All of this is the work of God preparing your heart to hear and to receive the truth. But ultimately, the final decision is up to you. It's like this verse says in chapter 10, God offers to every person forgiveness and salvation. He pleads for us to accept it, but he never forces our decision. He never makes us. He offers. He reaches out. He brings people into our lives, circumstances. He teaches. He helps us to know and understand the truth, but he never forces. At the end, God is always asking, inviting, would you accept the gift of salvation and forgiveness of sins? Revelation chapter 3 and verse 20 has this picture. It says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. This picture of Christ standing at the door of your life. I stand at the door and knock. If any man will hear my voice and open the door, I will come in with him and I will fellowship with him and he with me. This is the invitation that God gives to every one of us. And for some here, he's been standing there for some time. He's been knocking, he's been showing, he's been guiding, he's been directing, he's been revealing truth. And the invitation from God to you is if you will open the door, invite me in, I will come in, we'll fellowship. The forgiveness of sins that's promised in the scriptures will be yours in life eternal. There may be some this morning and you know that God's been knocking on the door of your heart, maybe for some time. But maybe today is the first time that you've truly understood what God wants. You'll never regret your decision to give him your life. And I pray that you do that even today, even this morning.